Let's talk with Steve Gilmore on Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain.
Perishing people right in the middle of a play?
Yes!
Good evening.
Oh!
Blimey, it's him.
I'm your next door neighbour.
Well, make the most of it, I'm moving tomorrow.
I just come round to borrow a pint of milk. My tippy hasn't had anything to drink all day.
I'm very sorry to hear it.
Of course, he only gets fed when I come home from work, you see. And he does like the top of the milk.
If you look, here's a quart. I must go.
You haven't got any fish as well, have you? Any old little bits will do. He's not fussy. Cobb Philip a place. Anything like that. He's a nice cat, he is.
What?
Nice cat.
Nice cat?
Yeah.
I've seen him digging up a rhubarb.
Classic comedy, which you can hear on this station every Sunday afternoon. The men behind that were Ray Galton and Alan Simpson. To find out a little bit more about them, we're going to talk to the author of a book about them, The Masters of Sitcom. Good morning and welcome to Christopher Stevens. Hi, Christopher, how are you doing?
Good morning. Hi, I'm very well, thank you.
A put a smile on your face there. Nice kickoff.
Yes, two of my passions, Galton and Simpson, and that was Kenneth Williams, you could hear, being importunate with his pussycat.
Well, do you know what? On my notes here, I've got down to speak to you about Kenneth Williams as well. So, because I know that you put a book together on him. So great that we've got that. I did say to you before we ran out, I've been trusted in my engineer here. I hope he's done it again. Well done, Alan. Right. Okay. Christopher, first of all, I mean, it's something that I've always loved, this classic comedy. For me, the best sitcoms are not... People always say this, oh, the best sitcoms were the older ones back in the 70s and the 60s and so on. For me, never a truer word spoken. But what, you know, looking at your bio, you're about the same age as me, what got you involved, got you so interested in this to start writing about them?
I've loved that classic comedy ever since I was a child, and I suppose the truth is that my sense of humour has never developed. I still laugh at the same things that I did when I was 7 years old.
Right, okay. And Galton and Simpson, true that they invented the sitcom?
I say so. They're very modest guys, and they insist they didn't. They tell me that it goes all the way back to Shakespeare. I tried to point out that there weren't even black and white televisions when Shakespeare was writing.
Well, no, I mean, I'm looking at, again, looking because we've got the way I wanted, when I was doing my research, looking at Variety and how they, and I know you cover it in your book, how they went from Variety to TV and the change on that. So let's go right back and talk about Ray Galton and Alan Simpson as two individuals. They met quite an unusual place that they met, wasn't it? In a hospital.
They both had tuberculosis. In fact, when Ray went into the sanatorium, he only had 6 weeks to live, and somehow he just managed to cling on to life. Incredibly, not only did they meet and become friends in this sanatorium, they were very young, both in their late teens, sort of 17, but they started writing comedy there for the radio station, the in-house radio. And when they were cured, streptomycin came along, the antibiotic that cured tuberculosis, and they left the hospital, and writing comedy was what they wanted to do. And with the confidence of the very young, they sent some gags to the BBC. They had this incredible natural talent and this almost telepathic connection, which they still share. And they laugh at the same jokes even before the words have been spoken. And it stood them in incredibly good stead. Within a few months, they were writing some of the hit shows on the BBC.
Now, that was just that, you know, the radio and radio entertainment starting up, I guess, back then. We're talking about the radio part before the TV here, are we?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, going back to that time, Christopher, Variety was where people got most of their entertainment, the old Variety shows, going to the theatre. And it was a very, almost a carry-on type of humour, because a lot of the comedy exponents at that time, I'm thinking of likes of the great Max Miller, for example. It was all a kind of nudge-nudge, wink-wink, naughty landlady, you know, all that kind of cheeky-cheeky chappy laughter stuff, wasn't it? To go from that kind of comedy to eventually move into sitcom, where the characters were so far removed from the Variety type of character, What was the journey that they went through? How did they develop these new comedy characters?
The catalyst was meeting Tony Hancock, who admired their writing immediately. And he didn't like that bawdy, as you say, nudge-nudge sort of humour. Ray and Alan really had an ambition to write shows that developed his persona and held a narrative all the way through the programme from start to finish, without any breaks for music, without any stand-up gags, without any punchlines, without any silly voices. And nobody was doing anything like that. I mean, we take it for granted now, the idea of a half-hour programme about a set of characters who are the same every week, and we follow them through stories. It's sort of like funny soap opera. And they invented that. They did it with Tony, who was willing to take that risk. They put a fantastic cast around him, not only Kenneth Williams, but Sid James, Hattie Jakes, Bill Kerr, and they created some of the funniest sitcom ever written with the very first show.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you say that, but again, as I said to my intro, we run that classic comedy every Sunday afternoon. Through the radio and through the old BBC radio, we're partners with the BBC, and it's still popular. As much as times have moved on and times have changed, you can still laugh at it, and it doesn't matter what age you are.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? They were writing characters who are universal. I think they feel closest to Dickens. If they had to name somebody who was their inspiration, it would be Charles Dickens for the universal characters who can be recognised in any society, any part of the world, any era of history. That's what they were trying to achieve. And they nailed those characters so successfully that versions of them keep occurring through sitcoms all the way through the next 50 or 60 years. So if you look at Basil Fawlty in Fawlty Towers, he's a relative of Hancock. You look at Ricky Gervais's character in The Office, or Father Ted, or Del Boy. They're all similar characters, that the perennial optimists and losers. We sympathise with them and we laugh at them at the same time.
Also, there's a degree of the failed intellect there as well.
Yes, like Harold Steptoe.
Yes.
Desperate to be educated and really hardly able to read and write.
And so they managed to create characters that people can relate to. People know somebody like that in their life, don't they?
I think most blokes, particularly as they get older, relate to it very closely, yes.
Well, because they become them.
We do turn into them, don't we?
As we get older, we start to just morph into them. But, I mean, that's what they stuck with, they kept it that. But for them, so what the question I have for you, the process of creating a character, was it just as simple as looking back to, as you said, you know, their inspiration was Dickens, so looking back to that type of character and bringing him into a funny situation? Or did they work hard on, right, here's the type of guy we want to do, and lock themselves in a room for a couple of weeks and create a character?
Very much the latter, yeah. They're fantastic observers. A lot of Tony Hancock's real-life character was transmuted into the stage persona. So although he wasn't really Anthony Aloysius St. John Hancock II, as they called him in the radio show, the characteristics that they exaggerated were the real thing. I talked to Tony's widow, Freddie, who lives in New York, and she said that Tony used to be just dumbfounded, the way that he would talk to them in all seriousness, tell Ray and Alan what he was thinking, what he was reading, what his political views were, and the next week he'd see that mirrored back to him in some exaggerated form that was very, very funny. She said it used to floor him every single time. Hancock was very determined that his role was to be the performer. He didn't want to write those scripts. And so the many famous lines that we all associate with Tony Hancock, you know, a pint, that's very nearly an armful, all of those famous lines, Magna Carta, does she mean nothing to you? Did she die in vain? That's Ray and Alan, Tony didn't write those lines and he didn't want to be the writer. But yet it's his personality shining through the character. Incredibly clever to do it.
And, OK, with Hancock, perhaps a separate case, but when it comes to, like, the Steptoe and Son, how did they go about matching up the character to the actor?
That, I think, must have been mined from very deep in their subconscious, because they invented those characters in an improvisation session. They used to work lying on the carpet of their office, whether it was a hangover from being in a tuberculosis sanatorium. They both found it easier to be creative when they were flat on their backs. And they were lying there one day trying to come up with an idea for a one-off show for something called a comedy playhouse. And they were just batting ideas back and forth. And the way they tell it, Ray Gorton said, "What about there's these two rag and bone men?" And Alan clearly didn't think much of that idea because he didn't say anything for about 3 hours. And then he kind of, "What was that you said? Two rag and bone men." And they started playing the parts out. And it became obvious that there were these two characters who had antipathy to each other, but they didn't know where the antipathy lay. They started writing down the dialogue, and it suddenly dawned on them that these guys couldn't escape from each other. So it couldn't just be a business partnership, and they were men. They couldn't be married. So what was that unbreakable bond? And one of them said their father and son. And at that point, the characters were suddenly fully formed. Is almost like a live birth. Knowing that they were father and son, everything else followed from that.
And the actors were someone that they had deep, you know, a way past they dealt with, or what was this? They in the scene both, at that time?
Yeah, I mean, Wilfred Bramble, who played the old man, mm-hmm. was well known for his old tramp characterizations. He was actually much younger than he looked. Harry Corbett was the young rising star of British theatre. He was following the same trajectory as people like Richard Burton, and he could have gone on to be a really serious actor. The problem was that voice that we remember, that very adenoidal Steptoe voice, was his real voice. And as soon as Steptoe had become a big hit, he did the first six shows of the first series. It was so successful that it was instantly repeated. By the time the series finished its run, they were getting over 20 million viewers. The whole country recognized Harry Corbett's voice as that whining son in the junkyard. But he couldn't go back and do Hamlet in the same voice. The theatre would fall about. It typecast him instantly.
That affected him, didn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, he never really did anything but Steptoe, and yet he was a great actor. Yeah. He could have been a very different sort of actor. On the other hand, you know, he has an immortality that I think any comic actor would envy.
Okay, well, the book is called Masters of Sitcom, and it tells the story of Alan Simpson and Ray Galton and how they spent, as we've discussed today, the story behind the sitcom and their lives in general. Now, moving on, because you have a number of books to your life, and some we touched on earlier on, Kenneth Williams. Again, another comedy genius, but someone who'd, again, like Hancock, died pretty unhappy.
Yes, the reason Kenny died unhappy was that he'd been ill for mm-hmm. several years and he couldn't cope with physical pain at all and never could. Reading his diaries, and I have in my filing cabinets, my bomb-proof, fireproof, burglar-proof filing cabinets in a library.
You're the only man, Christopher, am I right? That you're the only man that's read all of the diaries.
I know. Well, apart from Russell Davis, who did the edit 20 years ago, and I have the only key to the filing cabinet at the moment as well. Yes. As you go back through these volumes, it becomes obvious that the slightest physical discomfort, and I mean, you know, a pimple, literally, was enough to ruin not just a day, but a week for him. So by the time he reached his late 50s and he developed ulcers, the pain of that drove him completely around the twist. And so the reason that we think of him as a tortured soul is largely because of those final years when he was driven beyond endurance by the pain of gastric ulcers.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that.
No, it's... Don't get me started, basically.
Okay. Okay, 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 sorry.
But, me another time.
But we'll do a programme on Kenneth Williams. But again, another and comedy genius.
Oh, God, he was so funny, effortlessly funny. And that was what really interested me in him from the off, was how could this lad from a barber's shop in King's Cross, St Pancras, who had no dramatic education at all, suddenly switch on this completely developed comic personality? And the people who worked with him, like Stanley Baxter, who worked with him in the Army Entertainment Corps just after the war in Singapore, said that he was fully formed at 19, at 20. He didn't have to evolve. Uh-huh. It was almost as if he hatched. I find that fascinating.
Well, that book is called Born Brilliant, again by Christopher Stevens, my guest this morning. Christopher, looking at what we have, you know, as a great historian of the sitcom, looking at what we have on the TV now, is there anything for you that can compare, or we might be looking back in 10, 20, 30 years' time and seeing that as a classic in the same way we look at Steptoe and Son or Hancock's Half Hour?
I think the great sitcoms, rather like the great pop music, belonged to a particular era when it was developing, the 60s and the 70s. It's hard to imagine that anybody, however talented they are, could be writing pop songs as great as what the Beatles did. Similarly, I don't think there'll ever be another Gordon and Simpson.
No. I mean, there's one that's been running for a number of years now. My two teenage girls love it, and I just sit there, find it hard to even raise a smile, and that's My Family.
Yeah. In Between Us and Outnumbered and The Thick of It, there's some great sitcoms. But they're not changing the social fabric of Britain, which is what Gorton and Simpson did. They changed the way we talk. They brought working class argo into the living rooms of everybody in the country, whatever class they were. They introduced that kind of cockney humour, that resilient humour, and that ground has been broken. The pioneers were Gorton and Simpson, and nobody can ever replace them.
Okay, well, once again, the book is called The Masters of Sitcom, From Hancock to Steptoe. Christopher Stevens, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for asking me.
Thank you, bye-bye.
Let's Talk with Steve Gilmore on Talk Radio Europe.